the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Good evening and happy spring to all. Tonight on Education Now, we share an interview recorded on Tuesday, March 9th, with Belinda Rollins. Belinda is the director of the Transmission Project. The Transmission Project amplifies the power of public media and technology, nationally supporting organizations such as Low Power Radio, Community Radio and Art Centers, rural broadband initiatives, and social change organizations that rely upon them. The Transmission Project and their initiative, the Digital Arts Service Corps, is building a robust and diverse media ecology, enabling a world built upon the full participation of society. Before we get started, remember you can send comments during the podcast and after by joining us on our Facebook page, or by sending comments to my personal email address at hermes@pacific.net. So let's get started. Welcome to Education Now, Belinda Rollins, my mentor. Although she's nearly 30 years younger in the Montessori tradition, I am still happily learning from my peers, which has nothing to do with age. Belinda was the midwife to the birth of Education Now as a radio show while she was general manager at KZYX&Z, or Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, here in Northern California. Belinda is now director of the Transmission Project. Belinda joined the Transmission Project, how long ago, Belinda? 2.5?
It's going on 2 years.
Going on 2 years. And she's had over 25 years experience in media, in radio significantly, and she's been a guest here on Education Now when she was a general manager at KZYX&Z, because we always do a focus on the media and education, which is what we're going to do tonight again with Belinda. And so welcome, Belinda, and let's get started. This is going to be so fun.
Thank you. So, where would you like to start?
Well, I would like to start with your telling me about the Transmission Project and what you have been doing and what your hopes are. I noticed that there's something happening in Florida, and I was wondering if you were going to be a part of that. Was it from the
The Knight Foundation.
Okay. So
right, it's the Knight Foundation is having their We Media conference right now, which is about really the information needs that communities have across the nation. And so this event is mostly people who are producing media and getting information out into their communities, largely in a nonprofit space, but no longer that. I was just there last week for their advance event that was all foundations, organizations that support that sort of those information needs in communities. So I went as in my role with the Transmission Project, because we operate much like a foundation does in giving grants, except we support organizations who need capacity building support that are working in media and technology that serves communities. But instead of giving people money, we give them a human to help with those efforts. And that's the Digital Arts Service Corps that we have. It's a corps made up this year of about 50 VISTA members from AmeriCorps who go into communities for these organizations who have capacity building needs, And they are placed on the ground full-time for a year with those organizations to work on those projects. And projects range from, you know, helping a community radio station in Dallas actually figure out ways to get their programming online and greater community input into the programming. We have someone actually working on that project using social media to bolster community radio efforts. And we also have other more traditional projects around public relations, volunteer recruitment and management. Also, we have someone at the Prometheus Radio Project that's working on translating FCC rulemaking around low-power FM stations, translating the policy rules into information that community members and non-attorneys can understand. So it's a wide range of different sorts of projects that we support, and we're actually in the process right now of collecting all of the organization applications for the projects that we're going to be supporting next year.
Sounds really exciting and important. And I noticed in going to the website for the transmission project that you feature a little video clip from one of the fair directors. I can't remember.
Jonathan Nichols and Robert McChesney.
Yes, there we go.
And yes, and they are co-founders of Free Press.
Yes,
among many other things. Of course, Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation, and McChesney is still a professor in Madison, Wisconsin. But they have a new book coming out, as always they do. But the book is about the crisis in journalism, and one of their recommendations is that wouldn't it be nice if there were an AmeriCorps program that could place a Corps member in a radio station, for example, to supercharge that radio station to get more people in the community involved and to make that radio station stronger, and to which we say, hello, we're here.
Yes, that's
but
wonderful.
It's an interesting day on that point. Before you called today, I was listening to the digital inclusion event that the FCC is hosting today in Washington, D.C., where they're starting to talk about pieces of the National Broadband Plan. That's going to be announced on March 16th. It's a big day. Mark your calendar, because this is the first time that the federal government has put together a plan for how the U.S. needs to address broadband connectivity across the U.S.
I am so excited about that. I mean, I just really believe that this is one of the most important issues, is an open and free net, and that everyone has access.
One of their recommendations that they just trotted out today was they're going to recommend the creation, we can quibble with that word later, but the creation of a digital literacy corps, a group of probably AmeriCorps members who are placed in local communities to address digital inclusion issues around the country.
What a wonderful rebirth of VISTA that would be.
Right, and that's the exact work that we've been doing here at the Transmission Project for 10 years. We were born out of an organization called CTCNet, which stands for Community Technology Centers Network, which was at its peak was about 1,500 members of community-based computing centers, which were very traditional computing centers in the form of a room with 10, 20 computers and some basic computer literacy classes, how to use Word, how to use a mouse, you know, very, very, very vital and basic information for people who don't have computers in their own home. At that point, we were all working, those many years ago, back in the mid to late 90s, we were all working with just trying to get these set up, because it was hard for people to be able to afford a computer. It still is, but not as challenging as it was before. Prices
right.
have dropped so much. We were trying to get people to understand why it was worth $20 a month to get dial-up service. We were trying to help people understand these issues. And so this organization came about when the Corporation for National Service that supports AmeriCorps and VISTA they still at that point had a digital divide initiative. And so this organization was the first national core that was established in a public university, where University of Massachusetts Boston, to actually address digital divide issues nationwide. And we inevitably are the last one standing today. There are no other of these digital divide initiatives from that time still left. Even though there are some digital inclusion efforts at local levels, there's none left at the national level.
Right.
So we've been around for 10 years, doing this work and trying to learn the lessons on the ground. And although now we've moved from dial-up to broadband, many of the same challenges exist, because every time we could overcome one, technology would change and we would need to go down that next road and change with the technology.
Right.
So the National Broadband Plan calling for a core like that, as did the Knight Foundation. They just released their report on informing communities. I highly recommend this very easy-to-read report about sustaining democracy in the digital age. You can find it online pretty easy. We are recommendation 12 in there. They recommend creating a geek core to build the capacity of communities to create and get access to the information they need.
And what was the contact for that information, Belinda?
The report is from the Knight Commission on the Information Needs of Communities, mm-hmm. and the report is called Informing Communities, Sustaining Democracy in the Digital Age.
Wonderful.
Really, at this point, it's so well distributed now. If you just Google Informing Communities, or
Great.
Using the search engine of your choice, you will find it.
Yes, Informing Communities. That is beautiful. That is one. Thank you. Thank you for that. I feel like it's so important, especially because right now with this media, the net, we don't have a corporations controlling it. And unfortunately, even though the people own the airwaves, the corporations have taken such control of the radio and the television that for the people to actually really have a voice again. I mean, that was the promise of PBS. That was the promise of NPR. But I don't see that happened, Belinda. And so that's why I feel like my focus is just on really wanting it to stay open and with the ability for people to create the media, but also for not to have censorship, not to have the voices of people censored by media who stand to profit from that censorship. And so that's why, for me, that issue is so important. And the topic we're focusing on, the media and education, and I feel like I'm getting a terrific education just listening to you right now. And I get a terrific education when I'm surfing on the net, looking up information, and and also being able to take action using this medium. And so I think it's terrifically important. But then that we would have people who are expert like you are. I mean, your ability, you're such a fantastic techie, and I've learned so much from you, and I learned so much from my students and my children about this medium, I don't know that much about it, but I'm trying and I'm learning, and it's very fun. But at the same time, it keeps me, what you're saying is that Vista would provide volunteers or people in lieu of money. Mm-hmm. Like, what
right.
can you give? What can you give? Oh, you can give your time? Oh, I'm sorry, we don't need that. What we need is some hard cash.
And it's interesting. Some organizations would rather have the cash than the individual. And I'll go off on just a bit of a side jaunt with that. But in the 90s, it was very much in the 90s, a little bit into the 80s, and it certainly continued on to the into the 2000s. Foundations changed their priorities. At a time when the stock market was going gangbusters, many foundations who support community-based organizations decided that they no longer wanted to support just the general operating funds of nonprofits. Instead, they wanted to support new initiatives, new programs, and new organizations. So an organization wouldn't be able to get money, for example, you know, unless they were very lucky, to just keep the lights on. But they could get money to start a new program on top of all the programs that they already had, which put a lot more pressure on keeping the lights on. And in doing that, it created a dynamic with organizations that they would fundraise for these new projects and implement the new projects, but they would try to do it on the cheap. And they would try to do it in a way that they could take the program money that was awarded to them and use it for operations, because they needed that operating money in order just to do the, you know, to do the bookkeeping, to keep the phones going. I mean, all of the things that they have to do to operate in, you know, in any environment. So a lot of money that has been spent over the years on capacity building and special projects has actually gotten eaten up by this, you know, this survival mechanism that organizations have had to deal with. So by putting a person into the mix, suddenly there's no way to divert those efforts. And when an individual signs up for a year because they are very interested in completing a project, let's say installing, you know, a wireless network in a public housing development, a very tangible thing that someone has the skill set and the desire to come do, they can't get there and be told, oh, no, instead you get to be the receptionist. That doesn't work when you have a person in the mix.
So
these projects get done because there is a person involved. Instead of me handing over about $25,000, which is the cost of what we do,
right?
Instead, we give you a person, and you're much more likely to get that project done,
right?
With that person.
Well, you know, I can see several things that here that happened. First of all, when VISTA started, it started, I think, about the same time as the Peace Corps.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Pretty close, yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, it's okay. I don't have my details.
It's in that pocket, sort of, you know, Kennedy
right.
time. And had the support of a lot of people and the Volunteers in Service to America. I mean, I was very excited about it, and I think I told you I had applied, and then my friend at the time proposed the very week I got my acceptance from VISTA, and I, you know, I chose to take that path and didn't go with VISTA. But then, of course, I didn't seem to hear very much about it as the years progressed. And then from the conservative end in politics came this, you know, be a volunteer. Be a volunteer, and a lot of more liberal people heard that as, oh, you know, you're going to get people to go out there and volunteer instead of giving money to these issues, giving money to our schools, giving, you know, and it got all subverted somehow, and it was threatening. I see, too, that volunteers who have skills also are threatening to people who are paid.
Mm-hmm.
And so those issues come up, and so, you know, how to deal with those delicate issues when really what we want to do is have a free, uncensored media. We want to have great schools, And that's the goal. Now, I also don't think that, you know, people shouldn't be paying money for what they've done to the environment or for what they've done to oppress people. I'm not in that bag. So seeing it, you just say the word volunteer and everyone runs thinks you're a conservative, just like if you say President Johnson. And so, how to confront those issues, I think, you need a good education to face those things instead of a sensational education. If you can be sensational, then that's what sells, even in the NPR PBS media these days.
I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but on March 5th, the draft of the National Educational Technology Plan came out.
Uh-huh.
Have you had a chance to read this yet?
No, I haven't.
It's Transforming American Education, Learning Powered by Technology.
It's the U.S.
Department of Education. And then in preparation for talking to you today, I thought I should probably sit down and read this thing. And so I did. And it's a fascinating, it's the executive summary that they've released. I believe the rest of it's going to come out in a few weeks. But it's interesting. Approach to a revolutionary transformation rather than evolutionary tinkering for our education system. And basically take the approach of since technology is at the core of every aspect of our daily lives and work,
right,
that we need to put it at the core of our educational system.
Yeah.
And they really take some and at this point I'll call it interesting rhetoric, since how any of this is going to get moved forward remains to be seen. But really trying to leverage the power of technology, let me find this, to provide personalized learning instead of a one-size-fits-all curriculum, pace of teaching, and instructional practice.
Well,
and
that's
really
perfect.
Looking
I mean,
that
goal is perfect.
And they're really looking at changing how and, the approach of how and what people need to learn into a 21st century competency-based approach.
Mm-hmm.
So really looking at critical thinking, complex problem-solving, collaboration, and multimedia communication in every content area, and going so far as to advocate for research and development around the areas of how can you use gaming as an assessment tool as opposed to filling in bubble standardized test forms.
Right. Well, that's essentially what Chris does when he does FanWar, is that they take, it's a game, but you're acting it out, and they take current problems, and weave it in there. And so they're saying you can do that also with the gaming on the that you do at the computer, and I can see that that's happening. And in private schools, Belinda, this has been happening. And in
mm-hmm.
some of the more prestigious public schools that have not been affected by the Proposition 13 type of legislation, they opted out of it, like in Palo Alto, where they opted out of having their property taxes not going to education. And they developed as a community, the system of lots of different philosophies. And you can't believe how they use media and the kids podcast, and they're so computer savvy. And, it's just awesome what they're doing. So I know what they're talking about. I know what you're talking about. But I think what the big fear is that they're going to use this rhetoric, and then they're going to go into the schools that are hurting the most, and they are going to funnel these kids, and they're not going to leave them time to play, and they're not going to allow them to really be individual. They say individual, but what they mean by that, as someone pointed out to me, is that they can have like 1,000 students, and as long as they go over to them each by their own computer, right, and talk to them, then that's considered individual. And that's not what we're talking about. So that's why I have looked at it. But as you say, it's rhetoric, and we'll have to see how it's implemented. And they want to, Belinda, bring in entrepreneurs who have never had any experience in education. and they want them to then, you know, or some of them, to formulate these schools. And that's another thing I really question, that, you know, a person concerned about the monetary aspect of it alone and about pushing these kids as hard as they can in the technology and the mathematics will neglect the arts, will neglect music, will neglect, you know, what it really means to have an individual education, which isn't to be sitting at a computer and having a person come over and ask you how you're doing. I'm sorry.
I would agree with that. I have to say that the reading this document, and again, this is just a document.
Right.
There was nothing behind it. I believe that they are that this approach is going closer to where you're conceptualizing ideas of make sure that the standards are covered, but then using technology in real world application. Have children learn about how to solve complex social problems by designing a game.
Yes.
You know, actually, you know, designing games and
yes.
applications
yes.
and doing virtual modeling and rendering in a space where they're using the technology in the same way that someone in a career path would
yes.
to assess and learn and figure out the answers to the questions. And that one of the most hopeful sentences in here, and I wrote Athena right next to it when I saw it, is in their teaching recommendations section. It's so dry, but I think it really harnesses something that I know you can get behind, to provide pre-service and in-service educators with preparation and learning experiences powered by technology, and this is where it gets interesting, that close the gaps between students and educators' fluency with technology. So recognizing that the students are probably more fluent with the technology than
yeah.
many educators are, and saying how can we create a learning community using this technology so that the students aren't the only ones learning here, but also that the educators are learning and becoming more fluent in the process.
Well,
there's quite.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say there's quite an emphasis on in this about I hate the word that they use for it, productivity. But talking about, you know, how can you measure productivity when everything is assumed based on seat time, age-determined groups,
yes,
you know, and rather than organized around competence and, you know, and
well, you're,
and
you're,
what people need.
I understand.
But then they move into how, you know, how the gap in technology or technology understanding is influencing program and curriculum development and funding decisions when all of these decisions are made by people who don't understand the technology. And sort of how do you, rapidly introduce a very complex system and fluid system? Because I think you and I both agree that we want to see a very fluid use of technology and media within schools in order to create a learning environment that appreciates complexity and helps children to understand complexity so that they can that they can navigate it throughout life.
Yes, I do. You're talking Montessori really here when you're talking about the kids teaching the teachers, or you know,
mm-hmm.
or they call them guide, right? Because any person who's been a teacher for very long, hopefully has learned that they have learned so much from their students. I mean, I can't tell you. And that's the hope is not that the teacher is like up there giving, you know, feeding you stuff, but that you're on its journey together. And I could not, you know, my granddaughters have helped me navigate Facebook. You know, my sons, my students, you know, showed me how to use the computer. because we had it in school, and that was, at that time, you know, they were actually learning how to program because computers were much simpler. And because I was like, I don't want them to just be users, you know, I want them to create mm-hmm. with this medium. And so I know exactly where you're coming from, and most Montessori, I would say all Montessori teachers would totally agree with you that the kids, the students, the younger generation are peers to the older generation, especially in the use of this technology. And it's wonderful and it's exciting, but you know, if you aren't used to treating younger people as your peers, and if you are not used to giving them respect for what they can teach you, then it may be difficult for you. And I think that this kind of learning has been going on, as I say, in a lot of the more a lot of private schools or the more prestigious public schools, but where it has not been going on is in the schools for the poor, in the schools for people of color. That is where it has not been going on, where it is not happening, mm-hmm. because, you know, they're saying, we'll throw volunteers at them, we'll throw technology at them, but you still have to throw the money. Because the money keeps you with the latest technology. The money keeps you with the low class sizes. The money creates the kind of environment, you know, where you've got gardens and all of this other stuff happening that you learn is the best thing to do from the use of this technology. And so it's not like, oh, either you have the money or you have the volunteers and the technology. You have to have both. Do you
right.
understand? Yeah, I know you do.
Well, the other fascinating part about this is that one of their recommendations is about infrastructure, you know, creating a comprehensive infrastructure for learning when and where both students and educators need it. Mm-hmm. It's very focused on the learning needs of educators as well, which I really appreciate that. But in the infrastructure recommendations, They're very simple. Ensure that students and educators have adequate broadband access to the internet and wireless connectivity, both inside and outside school. Ensure that they have at least one internet access device and software and resources for research, communication, multimedia content creation, and collaboration for use in and out of school. And for all of the criticism I engage in with the administration and the execution of the broadband stimulus money and so many other pieces, I will say that at least when we're looking at these big policy documents, there are common themes.
Yes.
That do show a profound understanding and interest in advancing things such as communication as a basic human right.
Oh yes, yeah.
And it's fascinating to watch how the philosophy is not always being executed well in policy for any number of reasons that we could go down through in an equally robust media conversation. But to see this level of understanding that the infrastructure for a robust education in the country does not stop at school walls. I'm so impressed with this.
Yeah, well,
and
it never
these,
has.
These little I mean, pieces.
Yeah, if you know, and you know, any real school, you know, extends the classroom outside of those walls and always has, and you know. As the students get to, you know, to the age of 13, 14, they almost all of them, at least in a good system, have to be doing something in the community in order to, you know, to graduate even. I mean, those are the really profound goals of the best of education. It always has extended beyond the classroom. And working in the community, what most people associate with as public education is so damaging and has been for a long time. I would say at least 30 going on 40 years in public education for the majority of people, and it's only gotten worse. But all of these goals, I have a lot of hope, and people think I'm kind of and I'm not cynical about the current administration and its ability to enact profound revolutionary changes. I looked at some of the rhetoric and I was like excited but reserved, and also wanted to say, now why aren't you going to these private schools that have been doing this and to these model public schools that have been doing this instead of going to these entrepreneurs? That's what I don't understand. That's the little glitch that's missing for me. It's like they're not going to experts in development of the child and how the child learns and what's necessary in the environment, to grow. And they're not going to these schools, like, for instance, Betsy Coe, who has an amazing school in Houston, it's so exciting. And I look around here and I see there is one, I don't think any of the schools are doing podcasting quite yet of the high schools here, but I know the Anderson Valley High School has their own radio on the computer, their own radio station now, which is great. And I did see something about the government, they're talking about the way that they could do broadband for everyone is to use the high schools that have broadband, and then after hours, then that broadband could be used by communities. Did you hear something about that?
Yes, and the broadband stimulus package that is the round two of the applications for broadband stimulus money is out right now. Let me back up. So in the stimulus package, the Congress approved $7.2 billion to start, and it was clearly stated to start the development of universal broadband service in the U.S. It's going to take a whole lot more than $7.2 billion to ever make that happen. Mm-hmm. But, so they put this together. It's being distributed through the NTIA, which is the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Administration. Saying that, I believe that's the name of the institution, and also the rural RUS department as well. And so they've been doing this through two competitive rounds. The first round was for, I believe it was $1.6 billion of the $7.2. They had 1,800 applications for $1.6 billion that was worth about 20 times the amount of money that was available in the overall funding cycle. To either do infrastructure projects to unserved and underserved communities, to develop public computing centers, and to also create opportunities for sustainable broadband adoption in communities. Actually creating reasons why organizations and individuals would want to have broadband access to their homes and businesses. So all of this, with this $7.2 billion, high competition, we, at the transmission project, we've actually been looking at this data very closely from the round one applications of who was funded, who wasn't, why they weren't, who asked for money where, and just trying to make some sort of sense of all the data that's come of this. But in the process, they defined community institutions, especially in terms of public computing centers, as organizations such as education institutions, libraries, community colleges, organizations like that. And in doing so, they left the door open, but they did not name in that process grassroots community organizations. And by doing that, there was created an emphasis in funding these frequently municipally controlled organizations, libraries, schools, that are especially in this economic situation that we're in right now, are in the process of cutting hours, cutting staffing. There's a library system I was just reading about very recently that essentially they're not going to close any branches, but they're going to rotate which ones are open each day. So libraries won't be open every day in that community. So these organizations, have been given priority emphasis for public computing opportunities. But they close at 7 at night. Mm-hmm. They're not open every day. They've got decreased staffing happening right now. And these are the places where a community is supposed to turn for their broadband access.
Right, and so let's just close them. I know it will at some.
And I think there's a real ethical issue around this how can a student who needs access to the internet to have the same opportunities as someone in a different community who has broadband to their home? How can a student who has to take two buses or ride their bike 10 miles to get to the nearest library that's only going to be open till 7 o'clock? Be able to use that resource, that resource where they might not be able to save files to the computer, they might not be able to access all the sites they need to access, they might not be able to upload video if that's what they need to do. There are so many restrictions in place when you start talking about these types of institutions, which are all, crucial to communities, but maybe not the end-all be-all for the place for public access to these technologies.
Yes.
There needs to be a greater emphasis or at least availability of this funding for, grassroots opportunities to really get into the fabric of hyperlocal communities, not just hyperlocal communities, not just meaning, very tight geography, but also communities of need and use. When you need to know where you can find medical services for your child now, that's hyperlocal. Mm-hmm. Not just, within the square mile. And so really being able to support that kind of use all the way out to the household level, and not even the household level, but the mobile level, that is crucial. We just saw a report last week that over half of the population on the planet has a mobile phone. And many of those people who have those mobile devices, that's going to be their primary means to connect to the internet. They're not going to be using laptops and computers at a desk.
Right.
They're going to be using mobile devices.
Right.
And we're in a place in our communities where many more people have mobile devices than have computers even today.
Yes.
We need to be looking at ways to use those devices to enable students to be able to do the work they do, to enable families to be able to get the information that they need. As government starts putting more and more data online, do you really have to go to the library in order to do, to complete applications for social services? There's something inherently wrong about that methodology.
Right. I can understand reaching someone in an emergency with a mobile device. I'm having a hard time visualizing doing research on a tiny little mobile device, but an iPad that's coming out looks really cool, and I can imagine that, but you can't put that in your pocket, I don't think.
It's pretty close.
Is it?
even thinking about mobile devices, in terms of the Kindle.
Yes.
The book reader.
Yes.
That's a mobile device as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as more of those become internet internet enabled.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm those are viable options. And yeah. if you really look at, you know, the iPhone for all of its, you know, connectivity foibles with AT&T, again, a media monopoly on service for a device.
Yes.
If you look at what you can do with an iPhone,
and
the level of information, you know, that is transferable using a device like that, museums are using iPhone applications to get information, about exhibits.
Yes.
And the history of the work that are in those museums.
Yeah.
And there are so many different things that you can use.
I know.
You use these devices for. You know, we can't limit ourselves to bricks and mortar, and this goes right back to the technology recommendations, you know, in the tech plan.
Right.
We can't limit ourselves to seat time and bricks and mortar opportunities for learning. And every time we back ourselves into a public computing center mentality, we are backing ourselves up to the late 90s.
Yeah, I agree.
Instead of where we are today.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I do think that, because I'm a strong supporter of homeschooling, and of course, it makes it even more it makes it even more pleasurable to homeschool with a computer, with this technology, with an iPod. I mean, you can just you can find everything there, and then you could go out and enjoy the trees and all of these other wonderful things that being down on the concrete, in just all this commuting and everything, you know, just doesn't afford you. And so, but you'd think we'd be further along that path now, even in terms of just having smaller gatherings and communities of people who are, you know, want to get together, and then they, you know, in terms of, you know, doing your research and stuff, you can just go home and do it. You don't have to sit in one of those traditional kind of concrete buildings with all that concrete, or, you know, you don't have to do that. You could use them for sports and big performances and things like that, you know, but you don't have to have bells ringing and people standing and, you know, I mean, the future, the present, we can make it now. We can make it happen now, but we can't really get information out to the public about these ideas and have a good philosophical debate about it, because our media, the radio and our media television, has been so usurped by corporate interests who have a vested interest in keeping things the way they are. And so for that reason also, I think this new technology offers us an opportunity to take a gigantic leap in consciousness about education and technology, education and the media, and our world, and all the problems that we need to solve. I mean, all the problems we need to solve in education and the global climate change and in our communication with each other in the world can all be advanced to such a terrific level. We can take a quantum leap if we would just embrace what we've been talking about, Belinda, and what you've been talking about. And I feel like the Google founder, Sergey Brin, I think is his name, I think he agrees. I've read some of his ideas about education in the future. But of course, people would say, "Well, he has a lot to gain from from this vision of the future."
Well, only controlling the world's knowledge base. You know,
yeah.
That's not much to have there. I only want to control every print document that's ever been printed that's outside of copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that I don't think Google is doing fabulous work. Mm-hmm. And they're such instigators in the field. With, you know, at the same time that everyone who's doing the kind of work that we're doing here, the Transmission Project, we're all out here, you know, struggling around this broadband stimulus money and you know how to get it to continue the work that we do. And then Google says, well, you know, get out of that dysfunctional process. We're going to lay fiber to a community. Tell us you want it. Let's see who gets it. And so they're very good at getting in there and stirring up the pot. And I love that about them.
Yeah,
well, as such a huge organization as they are, and the fact that I even said, you know, Google this earlier and you'll find it. And, you know, there are definitely some challenges with that. But at the same time, they will make things happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
I know when I first got on Facebook, a lot of people said, oh, you're going to lose your, you know, they keep, you know, your privacy. They're going to keep that. They mm-hmm. have all that information on you. Oh, you're going to be watched. And I was sort of like, well, what do I have to hide?
Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes you hear, though, the opposite end of that, I don't want to be searched in that way at the airport. Well, you wouldn't mind it if you didn't have anything to hide. You know, and it's that two sides that, and I know we talked about this last time I was on your show, part of media literacy and part of critical thinking is partially the understanding that media is not good, it is not bad. It's about power and how power gets used.
Right.
It exists on a continuum where there are some good things and some bad things.
Right.
And
it's
some
not,
healthy
yeah.
messages and unhealthy messages,
good and bad.
And it's all about negotiating it.
It is, right. But when we're, I do want to back up, though, about censorship and about privacy. If I put it in writing, then, you know, I don't understand what I have to hide. If it's taken out of context, then of course, and it could be used against me if it was taken out of context. You know, that might be the case. But I think it's very different than the kind of searches at airports. Yes and no.
I mean, you've seen me on Facebook.
Yes.
But I'm very careful with my Facebook persona.
Yes.
Yet I'm completely unlocked. Anyone can view anything that is on my Facebook except for my contact information.
Right.
And even then, some of my contact information is unlocked. But I decided about a year ago that I was just going to unlock it. Anybody wants to see it, they can see it. But going back to the media literacy component of that, not many people are completely unlocked in that way. Plus, Facebook has changed some of their privacy settings where you can get out of them, but you have to know to go in there and get out of them.
I did.
But at the same time, there are people who aren't taught critical thinking skills or did not hone those skills. Mm-hmm. And they're finding roadblocks in the way of finding jobs because they don't know to go in and untag pictures that their friends put up of them throwing up at the party on Saturday night.
Well,
and
who wants to work for somebody who cares that you threw up at a party on Saturday night? I mean, I
when you're in
work
it,
there. I'm sorry.
I can 100% agree with that statement.
Yes.
But in an era where job scarcity is what it is.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, we're talking about the flip side of the coin.
That's
You know, and it's really all about where do you want your personal trade-off to be?
Don't ask, don't tell.
And so, you know, we're all reduced to a point now where we have to have the skill set with which to navigate these technologies to know, yes, this is an acceptable amount of information I'm willing to put out. No, this is not an acceptable amount of information. And we each need to be able to make those decisions for ourselves, but we need to have the information and know how to deal with the information to make those decisions.
Right.
And that's really the key point is information for the sake of information isn't useful. Government transparency initiatives that are just throwing data out there, as useful as that is, and how you're getting more than you ever had before, really just naked data sets isn't transparent. Actually, some might argue it's more opaque.
Yeah, I would.
Because you can't understand what just these reams of numbers mean. Instead, you need assistance in mediating that information, in making some sort of, you know, logical assessment of what that information is all about.
Yes.
Again, coming back to, you know, to overall media literacy, it's okay to learn through pictures. You know, things like that that have such a bad rap at times. But really, if it's imagery that will get someone engaged and help them understand what data means, then that's what people need.
Oh, I agree with you, and I think that that, you know, there is a language that has still not been really deciphered, and it is a picture language. And but, you know, you'd have to probably be so proficient in metaphor. So I think it's beautiful to learn through pictures and video, and using all of your senses is the way to learn. And the technology that can bring you all of that is wonderful. It's exciting, and I totally miss you. And I think you're just such an amazing human being, and I'm so glad that you were able to do this interview on Education Now, Belinda Rollins. And I hope that we'll do it again, maybe every year, so that you can keep us abreast and also put your critical thinking abilities behind it. And I thank you so much for being a great mentor to me, Belinda.
Well, I appreciate everything that you've ever done for me, too.
And
you've done a lot.
And I want to tell everyone that Belinda also has a radio show called Bubbles in the Think Tank, which is broadcast out of, can you give the call letters, Belinda?
Sure. It's WMFO. Online at WMFO.org.
And out of Medford, Mass, right?
Right.
Tufts
University, which is just a little bit north of Boston.
Right. Well, I heard that Amy Goodman is going to be at Tufts tomorrow.
That's correct.
In Medford. And so I thought, oh, gee, two of my most favorite women during this month of, you know, appreciation of women are both going to be at the same place in time and space. And I loved thinking about that. two of my heroes, Amy Goodman and Belinda Rollins. Thanks so much, Belinda.
Thank you, Athena.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Belinda Rollins and our focus on the media and education. I certainly did. Here is contact information for Belinda. Belinda@transmissionproject.org. That's all one word, Transmission Project. Contact for the Transmission Project is transmissionproject.org. And contact for VISTA, or Volunteers in Service to America, is AmeriCorps.gov, AmeriCorps.gov. Here are further contacts for information discussed in this interview. Contact for the publication Informing Communities from the Knight Commission can be viewed at knightcom.org. That's knightcomm.org. The contact for the President's plans to provide broadband to all, which Belinda quotes, can be found at benton.org. That's benton.org. contact for Bessie Coe's model private school in Houston, which I mentioned in this interview, is schoolofthewoods.org, and that's all one word, schoolofthewoods.org. Contact for the Palo Alto Public School System, also mentioned in this interview, is PAUSD.org. That's PAUSD.org. My personal contact is Hermes@Pacific.net. On Thursday, April 1st, Education Now will feature an interview with Mary Pat Palmer of the Philo School for Herbal Energetics, with a focus on children's herbal gardens and health. And on Thursday, April 15th, we feature an interview with Dr. May Sakharov, with a focus on online learning. I hope you can join me. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. I would like to thank Christopher Melville, board member, for all of his support in producing these podcasts. My name is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now, and I thank you so much for listening. Good night now.